It's my very great pleasure today to introduce Paula Gooder and indeed Rhianne Roberts, who has already done a beautiful job of explaining the work of the trustees. Paula is a biblical scholar with particular expertise on the writings of Paul, but with a wider and enormously dynamic understanding of New Testament interpretation. Paula works full-time for the Church of England as Director of Mission Learning and Development in the Birmingham Diocese. I wrote that sentence very, very carefully. She's the author of many books, including Let Me Go There, The Spirit of Lent, published in 2016, and the focus of this afternoon's talk, Phoebe, A Story, 2018. Today she's in Conversation, Reclaiming Phoebe, Historical Imagination, and the World of Paul. Please give an enormous Leaves welcome to our two speakers.
Hello, again, different hat. Paula, thank you very much for being at the festival.
Real pleasure.
I stood outside the tent yesterday because I couldn't get in for an hour listening to you talk about the imagination, and I enjoyed it hugely, and I'm very much looking forward to the next 45 minutes, 50 minutes or so with you. I'm going to ask Paula some questions probably for about 25 minutes or so, and then we'll throw the floor open to you guys. I'm going to favour an equal mix of genders, so women, don't be shy. I'm going to start by asking you, we had the official description of your job then. How would you describe what you do for a living?
But I work for the Anglican Diocese of Birmingham, and I am exploring ways to encourage people, mostly but not exclusively lay people, to become more confident about sharing their faith, about talking about what's important to them as Christians, and we hope to set up new worshipping communities, fresh expressions, different church plants, those kinds of things. So we're kind of looking at different ways of kind of encouraging people to be more excited about sharing their faith.
So a good moment in the day for you would be when what happens? You go, I did my job. What has always been
is when I get one of those conversations where the light goes on for somebody and they suddenly get who they are is really, really important to God, it's really important to the church, and they need to get out and do something about it. It's that kind of light bulb moment has always been for me the moment, the best thing in life, really.
And how did you get to where you are now? What was your, just a little short, Tracy, of your journey?
Well, I kind of need to go, in a way, I have no idea. I kind of look back and go, how did I get here? But I'll do a little pracy. My first job was teaching in a theological college, a place called Ripon College, Cuddesdon, just outside Oxford, where I taught Old Testament, slightly bizarrely, because I'm a New Testament expert. And then after that, I taught New Testament at the Queen's Foundation in Birmingham for another 6 years. And then at that point, I had young children, and holding down a full-time job was nigh on impossible. So I then went freelance. The idea was that I was going to do a teensy little bit of speaking and a lot of looking after the children, and life would be calm and happy. It didn't quite work out that way. It was more the other way. But I did that for about 10 years. Then I got a job at the Bible Society, and I was theologian in residence at the Bible Society, and then most recently the job in the Birmingham Diocese.
So why do you favour the New Testament over the Old Testament?
Because I love it. I love the Old Testament as well, but there's always been something about Paul that has just fired the imagination. Paul, for me, is such an incredibly huge thinker, and it's really hard to keep up with the way in which he does his thinking, but every time I read something by Paul, it just expands my horizons, and I get incredibly excited about his vision. So yeah, there's something, it's just, his thinking is so amazing.
And what's his greatest thought? The line, you know, if you had one moment.
Well, I'm a big 2 Corinthians fan. So basically for me, if anyone in Christ, new creation, is technically what it says in the Greek, which can either be translated as, if anyone is in Christ, they are a new creation, or if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. And I think he meant both. I think that kind of whole idea that once there is somebody who is in Christ, new creation breaks forth on the world. And for me, that's right at the heart of everything that he's talking about.
I had a moment listening to you yesterday, and you were talking about 2 Corinthians, and everyone was there. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw a 7 foot high inflatable dinosaur prance. And that for me was Greenbelt in a moment. It's fantastic. Anyway, that brings me neatly to Phoebe. So not. So there are various. I won't say minor characters because they're not. No. But there are people who seem almost like incidental, whose names are dropped.
Yes.
So what was it about Phoebe that made you place her at the centre of your... Well, name your book after her, and it's her whole story.
Well, the thing about Phoebe is she's... For years, I've read commentaries on Romans, which I realise is a really sad sentence. But for years, I've read commentaries on Romans and got to the bit in Romans 16 where pretty much all scholars agree a certain amount of things, which are that Phoebe was a deacon in Kenchreae. No one's quite sure what that means, but she's a deacon. That she was the person who brought the letter of Romans from Kenchreae, which is in Corinth, to Rome, which therefore means she is the very first ever exegete of Romans, which is amazing. That she was sent by Paul from Corinth to Rome to set up his Spanish mission. So we read in Romans that Paul is intending to go from Rome onwards to Spain. What he says in Romans is, and I paraphrase, you will gather, I'm just popping to Jerusalem to drop off the collection. And once I've done that, I'm going to get to Rome and then I'm going to go on to Spain. If you read Acts, you'll realise it didn't quite work like that because he ended up in prison and had to come via a long route into Rome. So she was sent to set up the Spanish mission. That she was, and the Greek word again of Phoebe is that she was a prostatis, which many people, when English translations, translate as she was a helper or a benefactor. Now, if that word is used of a man outside the New Testament, it's normally translated as a patron. And it's just striking that she's come downgraded into a helper. So a patron in the Roman world is somebody who is very wealthy, who has clients, that the clients come and in the morning they're given jobs to do. And so they are a really significant person in the Roman Empire. So Phoebe isn't a helper, she's a patron. So she's a deacon, she's setting up, she's bringing Romans to Rome, she's setting up the Spanish mission, she's a patron, and scholars generally agree that the name Phoebe is the name that's given to slaves. So you've got this person who was apparently previously a slave, now incredibly wealthy. So Romans commentaries just kind of slap those five facts down and go, right, Romans 16:3, and on they go. And I'm going, wait, that is just intriguing. So for 20 years, I've had these five things about Phoebe going, this is one incredible person. So I wanted the opportunity to explore her a little bit more.
Now, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but... No, I'm not. I'm really, because I want to ask you the question, and because I think I know the answer. But so, why has Phoebe not been fully explored and celebrated so far? Because,
well, there's loads of reasons, aren't there? One of them is because, like many characters in Paul's letters, we discover about her for two verses and on we go. There's, you know, let's kind of do the clear-sighted thing. We don't know a lot about Epaphras or about Sosthenes or about Timothy, actually, very much. There's a whole load of bit characters and we focus on the main characters. So there's a whole load of bit characters in the New Testament that we don't know a lot about. But, of course, secondarily, she has the fortune... stroke misfortune of being a woman, and therefore we're even less interested in who she is. But I would just like to say we don't know a lot about Sosthenes either, who is also an intriguing character in the Pauline world. So it is that kind of bit character stuff in the New Testament.
It's odd though, isn't it, that Phoebe is who she is and the church has been how it has been about women.
Yes.
It is. Odd is a kind word
yes.
to describe.
Yes, so let's be generous this morning and say it's odd. I think it is really interesting, and it's one of the things that some of you will have heard me say this already, that when we talk about Paul and women, I think we start in the wrong place. Because normally where we start is with the three passages, 1 Timothy 2, 1 Corinthians 14, 1 Corinthians 11, and I do them in that order for a reason. Because basically what people do is they read 1 Timothy 2, and in the light of that they read on to 1 Corinthians 14, which is the stuff about women speaking in church, and then 1 Corinthians 14 is read on to 1 Corinthians 11, which is the stuff about headship, and therefore a decision is made about what Paul thinks about women. But what we never do is actually see what Paul thinks about actual women, you know, the real women in the community who are doing things. And for me, the really interesting thing is you've got Phoebe, you've got Junia, you've got Euodia and Syntyche, you've got Lydia, Eunice and Lois, you've got lots and lots of actual women who are apparently having incredible roles within the community. And at which point I want to say, well, you cannot come up with an interpretation about what Paul thinks about women that doesn't allow for the actual women who are actually doing things in his actual communities, rather than your abstract ideas. And so we've kind of gone in it from the wrong direction, I think.
So why is there that inconsistency?
Well, I think that what happens, and we still do it today, and it's worth just reminding ourselves that we do it today, is we read Paul, we read a lot of the Bible, knowing what it already says, you know, with a kind of a prejudged conclusion. So in a society that didn't allow women to have public roles, of course we know that Paul doesn't allow women to have public roles. And so we read kind of with the grain of our society rather than necessarily with what Paul actually said. And for me, one of the really striking things that we need to do is to say, well, what are we reading with the grain of our society against what the authors originally said? And then I would add to that, well, we just need to then to do a little bit of creative thinking about to what extent do we think that with the grain of our society is right today, and to what extent do we need to learn something from what the Bible is saying?
It is an extraordinary book. I really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you.
Just because it brought alive, you say at some, I think it's in the footnotes, that the letters have no they have no story.
Yep. Yes.
And putting a story around ideas is what you're trying to do in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about how you imagined her and her life out of what you had? Because obviously there's can you have a shed load of scholarship? There's a shed load of scholarship.
Yeah, you can have a shed load of scholarship.
Well, you've got several shed loads in there. And then out comes this vivid character. And, you know, how did you do that?
Well, to start with, from those five facts I just told you about, once you get a former slave who's very wealthy, who has a position in the church, the first exegete of Romans, sent off to set up a mission, that is such fertile ground. You don't have to try very hard. So one of the things that for me was that it was a story that was begging to be told. When I say begging, I should say that it took me about 5 years from first idea to writing it, because it begged to be told, but it wasn't easy to tell it. So what I did was I tried to imagine what it might have been like for a woman who had been a slave then to find herself in this particular position. So without trying to spoil it for anyone who's not read it, and one of the things I was trying to reflect on is what would it have been like to have been a female slave in the Roman world? What's the kind of baggage you bring with you once you've got that? And then how do you live up to a vocation? Because it's really, for me, a story about how somebody lives into the vocation that everyone sees that they've got, but finds it hard because of who they are and the baggage that they bring with her. So for me, it's a story about how you live through your baggage into vocation.
The other thing that struck me was how brave she was. Even from the five facts that you have, that's one brave woman.
Absolutely.
And that bravery that isn't the derring do type bravery, but a kind of an attention to detail and planning that would have allowed her to be brave.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think one of the things I really also wanted to do is to tell that story of everyday life, which is courageous. And there are many, many people I know who have simply getting up in the morning is a courageous act because of the things that have happened to them in their lives. And I wanted to kind of explore that kind of tale about what it feels like to be someone who has suffered much and is courageous in what isn't necessary to us, may not look to be that big a deal, but is actually an enormous deal.
And have you heard people coming up to you and going, actually, I think you've got that wrong, Paula? That look. I think you're wrong.
Not yet. But there's always time. I was absolutely terrified when I wrote the book that, you know, a week in, I would get those green emails, you know, the ones that are typed in all capital letters. You know they're going to be bad. You just open them and go, ugh. Thus far, I haven't had a single one. But I'm just saying thus far. I'm sure I will.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's plenty of people out there. Mm. Yeah, I met one last week.
I've met many.
Sure, I don't know how you do it, actually. I'm sure you have a deal of patience and wisdom that I haven't been blessed with. Why do you think we have so little detail of these incidental characters?
Because we do. I mean, this is really obvious, isn't it? But I think one of the really interesting things about the gospel stories is we forget that each one of the, well, I've said gospels, haven't I? But gospels, New Testament, Paul, it was packed with people with huge lives who get a tiny mention here and a tiny mention there because the gospels were about Jesus and Acts largely about Paul. You have a single main character and then you get a lot of bit part people. That's how narratives work. And one of the things I think is really striking is you simply cannot tell a narrative while giving everyone equal position in the story. So I did toy for a while about making it a story about Phoebe and Prisca and Junior as equal weight characters, but you can't tell a story that way because you get, I know if you've been in those, I love novels, so I read loads and loads of novels. One of my most hated novels are where you've got such a huge cast where you're going, who is that person? I can't remember who that one is. And you have to go and read back again. And you kind of get really, especially if they've got similar names, then you're just done for. So actually the way in which we tell stories is always around a central character with bit parts. So the Gospels and the New Testament generally have told a story with a central character and bit parts. What I've just tried to do in this is make a different person a central character.
Yeah, because I was fascinated. I mean, I'd never come across Junior before, and I can't remember the exact word. She's described as the most honoured apostle.
Prominent among the apostles.
Prominent.
Probably.
So what does that mean? And therefore, why do we... No, I can't ask the why do we know so little. I understand
that.
Yeah,
that's right, yes, sir.
But what would have made her most prominent amongst the apostles?
Well, I think I need to do an answer before that, which is the most disputed verse in the whole of Romans 16, possibly in the whole of Romans, is Romans 16, verse 7, which is about Junior. So Junior, who incidentally Paul talks about, is one of my kin, Paul talks about. So one of the questions is she an actual relative or is she Jewish? Probably Jewish. And then Paul says she's prominent among the apostles. There are books written on Romans 16:7. And the reason why they are is that people dispute, A, that she was prominent among the apostles. Some people go for a translation which is well known to the apostles. And B, that she was a woman. So either you can have... So there is a certain view, and I shall leave you to work out who holds these views, that either she wasn't an apostle, was just well known to the apostles, and she was a she, or that she wasn't a she was a he, and therefore was prominent to the apostles. And the reason why she was a he is because the name Junior, if you turn it into Junias, would be a male name rather than a female name. Just, I have to drop in at this point, that Junior is a really, really common name in the Roman world. There are hundreds of examples that you can find of people called Junior. There are no examples at all in any text that anyone can find of any man being called Junias. But for some people, it's a more reliable interpretation of the text. And I shall leave that with you like that. But anyway, now go on. Now I shall answer the question you actually asked, which I think is utterly fascinating. The reason why it's such a disputed verse is, for some people, it is physically impossible for a woman to be an apostle, and therefore Romans 16:7 can't be saying that a woman was prominent among the apostles. What for me is absolutely fascinating is, I think, of shock news, everyone, just as well most of you are sitting down, I think she was prominent among the apostles. And I think that, therefore, is really significant. So apostle in the early church was someone who was sent to proclaim the good news. They were people like Peter, James, John, Paul. These are the characters who were the apostles. And not only to be an apostle, but to be prominent among the apostles is a really striking thing. So she was somebody who was entrusted by the early church community to travel around the world, or the known world at that point, proclaiming the gospel. So she was a hugely significant character. And therefore, I just think she is quite amazing.
I must admit, you know, the book gave me a renewed confidence in the role of women now. I mean, it just brought them so beautifully to the... to the front of the stage, and I thought, oh yeah, thank you. So I commend the book for lots of different reasons, but you know, if you need a little bit of fire in your belly, ladies, good book. And gentlemen, of course. One of the passages that I enjoyed the most was when you bring Peter into the story, and there's that conversation explaining forgiveness.
Do you know, that's the one that I've had most different opinions on.
Oh.
Some people love it, some people hate it, which is very interesting.
But it seemed to me that your writing became so confident in your reimagining of him. And I wondered whether you had an especial fondness for him. Well, it came through for me, and that notion of forgiveness felt absolutely central. Mm. It's
the main theme. And for me, it is. If there is a single main theme, the theme is forgiveness. And it's that long-lived-out forgiveness. Not because I think one of the things that I've been really wrestling with over a number of years, and I was triggered by, and I'm going to forget her name, but it was the mother who was a priest in the Bristol diocese whose daughter was killed in the July bombings. And there was a beautiful, beautiful docudrama about her on television, if anyone remembers it. And what she said was that she couldn't anymore minister in church because what we said about forgiveness was so trite that it no longer felt real for her to be able to minister in church. And it was kind of one of those that kind of really hit me deep in my heart, that I therefore wanted to say, and therefore what we're saying about forgiveness is church is wrong. So that was, in a way, that was kind of what I was trying to do with that kind of Peter story. Because often when we talk about forgiveness, it's kind of like there's a switch and there's not forgiveness, and you flick the switch and there is forgiveness. Ta-da! And it's all really easy. And what I was trying to do was to kind of tell that story about how forgiving and being forgiven is a really long narrative. And that's what I think is going on in John 21, is you've got this kind of lovely, lovely long narrative between Jesus and Peter, where Jesus walks Peter through beat by beat about why he can feel forgiven. And that for me is one of the key things. And it comes from a personal experience, if I can share. I won't tell you the exact personal experience because you would know who it was. But something happened to me at one point, which was appalling. It was somebody who was in a very powerful position, and he was very abusive to me in public in front of a lot of other really powerful people, and no one stepped in and did anything about it. And what was really interesting is that he was clearly instructed later that he had been inappropriate. So he summoned me. And he summoned me and said, I gather you're upset. If you are upset, I'm sorry. And I did the kind of female thing largely, though not exclusively. I think men probably do it as well, of going, oh, that's fine, it's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm good. And went, left the room. But of course, it wasn't fine. And for about 2 years, it kind of stuck in my soul, and I could not get past it. And eventually, I had a conversation with someone about it. And he said, it was Lent coming up, pray for him every day. And I went, not happening. But in the end, I did. And sometime between Ash Wednesday and Easter, I forgave him. I'm not quite sure at what point it was, but one moment between Ash Wednesday and Easter, I suddenly realised it was gone. And for me, it was that recognition that forgiveness is long. It takes discipline. It requires you to do it time and time and time again. So what I'm trying to do in the book is to talk about forgiveness as a life discipline rather than as a switch that we flick on and off.
I found that really helpful. I mean, I'm sure that many of us in church communities find forgiveness is an ongoing piece of work, and it is work, but it was a very helpful and beautifully written passage. That was the best part of the book for me. Which was the best part of the book for you? We don't say that bit. Well, you can if you like, or your second best if that is your first.
For me, it's the moment, and that for me is kind of what the whole book is about, the moment when Phoebe feels able to live up to the vocation. The trouble is I'm trying to explain it to you without, for people who haven't read the book, without telling you what it is. When you read it, you'll see what I mean. There's a moment in the book when everyone knows she has a vocation and she hasn't been able to see it. And it's the moment where she can go, okay, that is my vocation. Because that's kind of, in a way, my story. So somebody tweeted me the other day and said, how much of this is Phoebe is you? Quite a lot, really. It always is, isn't it? And for me, one of the things is that accepting your ability to live into your vocation is struggling. It's hard. It's really, really difficult. And I'm not saying I've succeeded, but for me, that was the moment for her, where that moment where she suddenly said, okay, I can do this now.
I mean, I don't want to spoil the book too much either, but I'm just going to say the character of Felix, that's another lovely parallel story that's running through. Felix doesn't exist anywhere.
I made him up completely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Felix is a young slave boy who who is now freed for other reasons than Phoebe is freed, and he and Phoebe meet each other early on in the story, and there is something around family for Phoebe. Again, not trying to give you any spoilers, but Felix becomes family for Phoebe before other things begin to be resolved. And for me, there was something really important about that recognition, and many of us will have had that, is if you meet people at really vulnerable times in your life, that their vulnerability and your vulnerability kind of meet and seal in a way that doesn't happen in other moments, and family emerges. And I think for those of us who have complex experience of family in the past, there is something about the emergence of family in the most surprising places, which is for me the heart of the gospel as well.
I've got a couple more questions and I'm going to open it up to the floor. I went to hear Rowan Williams speaking about poetry relatively recently, and he said, he used an expression which I loved, which is, there is no last telling of the story. And you referred to that in your session yesterday. So is there, what's next? What's the next story that you'd like to have a go at, one that needs revisiting?
Well, I want to kind of tootle around most of Paul's women and do and do different versions. So my next one is I want to do something based on Philippians and do a thing around Lydia, who is the very first Western Christian, we learn from Acts, who then disappears out when Paul writes Philippians to the people who live in Philippi. Lydia isn't there anymore, but Paul talks about two women, Euodia and Syntyche, who used to be friends and have fallen out. So I want to have a little exploration around Lydia, Euodia and Syntyche, because I think that will be really interesting, because what I've done in Phoebe is explored what it was like to be a Christian in Rome. That would allow us to explore what it's like to be a Christian in Macedonia, which is a different part of the Roman Empire with a whole load of different experiences for women. So you can just kind of do a different context with some more really fascinating women.
And one last thing for me. Before we began speaking with microphones, I said to Paula that she was the Mary Beard of theology.
And that's my great heroine. I'm good with that.
Yeah, you're considerably younger than Mary, but she's a star, as are you, I think. But and it's to do with something you said yesterday as well, which it felt to me that in order to have permission to start imagining a life for these characters, You have to have done the work. And it's quite hard for mere mortals who are doing other jobs, but, you know, to get permission to imagine some of these characters. That feels like a real challenge. And also, I felt a bit sad yesterday because I was thinking, okay, I've got time to do the work, so I don't have permission to do the imagining.
We then had a conversation in the questions in which this kind of emerged further, which is to say, absolutely everyone's got the permission to do the imagining, and you can do it from what you know. What I'm trying to say is that often we get a little bit lazy, and we forget to notice which bits we've put into the story and which bits we haven't put into the story, which are genuinely there. So I think one of the things I would want to say is imagine a way. It's the only way you can possibly engage with scripture. But actually, wouldn't it be better if you could actually imagine it with greater insight and greater knowledge? So kind of do it anyway, but you might just be interested to ask. And these days, with the help of Google, you can become an expert in all sorts of stuff. And for me, one of the really striking things is every time you ask yourself a question, I wonder what that might mean. And Gwana, what I was trying to do in Phoebe is to go, look, there's so much in Romans you could simply ask a question about. Just Google Roman adoption and you'd be able to get all of that stuff for yourself. And all you'd have to do is ask the question and know you needed to ask Google it, and you could get a whole lot more depth. So it's being aware of what you don't know and being curious and confident to ask those questions, I think.
Going back to source.
Indeed. Yes.
Thank you. I feel cleverer. So questions. It's going to be hard to get a mic out to you, so put your hand up, shout loudly, and I'll repeat it, and Paula will provide a wonderful answer. Who's first? Lady there in the purple. The question is, in the time of Phoebe, how were women taught? In the time of Jesus. It's roughly the same thing. All right, come on, give me a break. How were women taught? Were they taught by other women or were they taught by men?
Two answers. So many more answers. I'll start with two. It all depends where you were. One of the really striking things is people will say, what was it like in the first century? And the answer is, well, it all depends where you lived. You know, did you live in the Holy Land? Did you live in Rome? Did you live in Macedonia? Did you live in Asia Minor? Experiences were different at different places around the world. But largely speaking, if you were Jewish, you would have learnt at your mother's knee, probably boy or girl, until you get to the age of 12, when you would then be sent off as a boy, off to learn with a rabbi. In Rome, it was much less common for girls to be taught than for boys. Boys would often have a tutor. But there are some really interesting examples in Rome of wealthy men who made sure that their girls had an education. So it was a very, very varied picture. The thing I would say, that's the first half of my question answer. The second half of my answer is the really, really striking thing about Christianity in the first century is we have evidence of women being taught like the men were taught. And of course, the one that you will know immediately is Luke 10 and Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus. And sitting at the feet of a rabbi was how you did your learning. What was happening is Mary was signalling that she was a proper rabbi, like a proper disciple, like a man would have been, sitting at the feet of the rabbi. So what you've got within Christianity is a cultural change in which women learn. Now, here's a little radical bit I'd like to throw in. 1 Timothy 2, that very beloved passage about women and in Paul. Actually, what is said there, I think is really interesting. At one point, we can't do the whole exegesis of the passage, but one little phrase is where Paul says, let women learn in silence, which is normally understood as how awful he is, that they have to shut up. First thing to notice is that the verb for learn there is the verb from which you get the noun disciple. So if it's in a noun, it's disciple. So Paul is saying, let women be disciples. And the word that is normally translated as silence actually means tranquility or quietness. So if you translated that as, let women learn in tranquility. And I don't know a single woman who wouldn't go, thank you very much, that would be lovely. So actually, even that most hated passage suggests to us that what Paul is saying is, let women learn. Let them be proper members of this community, which therefore transforms your image about what's going on, I think.
Oh, you are smashing, you know. A gentleman there in turquoise. I recently saw a film about Mary Magdalene, full of imagination, beautiful. Was Mary Magdalene an apostle?
It all depends how you define apostle. She was sent, as many people will know, she was sent at the resurrection to proclaim the good news to the disciples. The word apostle means someone who's sent. So if you take it in the broad generic sense, yes, she was. She isn't termed an apostle in the New Testament, but I think probably would be my answer.
Another question. Gentleman at the back with the flat hat, cap. Fine cap.
I think...
Can you repeat the question?
I was so excited already, I was jumping in. So the question is, I've been talking about 1 Timothy, saying Paul said... there is a theory that the pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, are not written by Paul. What's my opinion? I was so excited, I just started in. I think the pastorals and Ephesians and Colossians are Pauline, as in not Johannine, and so on. And for me, it all gets you back to the whole stuff about how stuff is written in the New Testament period. It is clear from Paul's letters that it's highly unlikely that he actually wrote any of his epistles, because you'll probably know in Galatians, he signs off at the end going, I've got really terrible handwriting, because implying that his eyesight is really bad, and therefore indicating that he didn't write the rest. In a world in which scribes were highly significant and were, and we have evidence from the Roman world or a table of charges for your scribe, whether it be straight dictation through to creative writing on behalf of the person who wants it written. And I am very, very relaxed to say this is Pauline, whether Paul was standing at the shoulder, looking over, going, no, not like that, like this, through to sending a note out of prison saying, I want a letter written, and I want it to say this, 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 and this. Can somebody do it? Through to a Pauline community knowing what Paul thought and then writing it down subsequently. And in a way, I don't really feel I need to make a decision precisely about which one of those is written in that point. When I was a graduate student, I decided to be a little bit controversial and use the arguments for the non-Pauline authorship of the pastoral epistles to argue that Paul didn't write Romans. Just because I could. Because, you know, like you do when you're a student. And what that allowed me to do is kind of do that playing with the whole stuff around authorship. So I think that's my long answer. I think it's Pauline. I don't really care where Paul was in that precise process. It is Pauline thinking, and that's enough for me.
And Our Lady in Red. Oh, I won't sing.
Absolutely. Do you want to repeat that?
Yeah, so the ladies sing. In your book... you love novels. You love novels. You've been very careful not to describe the book Phoebe as a novel. So would you like to say more about that?
I would love to. And it's a really interesting one. And the place, you know, in terms of people who disagree with me, the biggest area of disagreement is it a novel or not a novel? I still maintain it's not a novel. And the reason why are kind of a range of reasons. One of them is because novels for me are driven entirely by the story. You have a vision of story and the story itself takes over. And you don't know in a novel where it will end because the story itself is the thing that generates it. I was very clear right from the start that this is theology dressed up in story, or theology done through the lens of story. It didn't have permission to go wherever it wanted to. It needed to hit certain key bits. So that's one reason. Another reason is because actually what I'm trying to do is to communicate actually how you can read Paul in an imaginative and interesting way. That's why a third of the book is footnotes. Because what I'm trying to do is to say, these are what we know about the Pauline community. And no novel that I know has a third of itself as a footnote. But what I'm trying to do in that is to say, we can weave a story, we can kind of understand something kind of deep in our hearts about what this means, but we can also say, and we know this, and we know this, and we know this, and these are the markers that mean it can't go off in that direction. So I had a long wrestle with the publishers about precisely what it was going to be called, and in the end I managed to smuggle onto the title page inside, though not outside, the subtitle. So the title is Phoebe, the subtitle story, the subtitle is Pauline Christianity in Narrative Form, and for me that's what it is. It is an exploration of Pauline Christianity told like a story.
Yeah, I wouldn't have described it like that, you know. But then again, yeah, I do a different job for a living. Who have we got down here? I just want to make sure I'm doing this fairly. Chap. I need to paraphrase that, don't I? So slavery is a big theme for Paul. So how does that influence Phoebe's approach to her understanding of Christianity and Christian life? Fair enough? Yeah.
What I'm trying to do in telling the story is to... help us see that, and when Paul uses key technical terms from the Roman world, it would have had emotional impact on the people originally hearing it. So one of the things that, when you get to do stuff in the original language, you end up being really, really grumpy with other people's translations, which is really easy to do because they're not my translation. I can be grumpy at their translation. I couldn't do a better job, but you can be grumpy at them. And one of the things that I'm grumpy about a lot of English translations is they slip between translating two keywords, doulos, which is slave, and diakonos, which means servant. And often you will get in English translations, they translate doulos as servant. And if you ever kind of come across that kind of thing, you will hear me in the back going, because there is something really, really important, and it has a real emotional connection in the first century, the difference between a slave and a servant. So a slave is owned, a servant is paid. But they don't have the lens of what happened in the 16th and 17th century. You know, we've got this huge load of reading about slavery, which they, of course, didn't have because it hadn't happened by then. And slavery is normal in the Roman world. It is varied in experience. So some slaves chose to remain slaves for the whole of their lives because they were way better off than they would have been if they hadn't been slaves. Other slaves were appallingly abused. Many, many slaves were freed. It was really common. The thing I learned when I was writing Phoebe that I didn't know before was how common it was to free slaves in Rome, because basically what they did was they go and conquer a new land and take everyone as a slave. And it was a kind of a deal that you'd be slave for about 10 years and then you'd be freed. So much so that various emperors laid down legislation about how many slaves you were allowed to free in your will, because if you freed too many, the economy got distorted and it was all very difficult. So it, kind of the freeing of slaves was really common. So you've got this kind of whole economy of slavery going on in the Roman world. Nevertheless, no one who didn't have to become a slave would ever choose to become a slave. You just wouldn't do that. So when Paul says, I am a slave of Christ, or you are to be slaves of Christ, you should hear the audience going, you know, which when you, in the English translations, dilute it down to being a servant of Christ, that's kind of a lot easier to hear. So there is a lot in Paul, I think, about the importance of slavery and actually the offensiveness of what Paul is saying. Paul offensively says time and time again, you are slaves of Christ. But then he kind of goes on to say in places like Galatians, and that's the greatest freedom you're ever going to encounter. So he's subverting and playing, and therefore it's a really, really important idea. And so every time you come across that, so therefore from now on, whenever you're reading Paul and you read the word servant, you might be interested to see if you can find out whether it is in fact genuinely servant or not, because it does make quite a big difference to what he's talking about.
A lady at the back over there.
Well, the really...
Paula, you need to repeat the question.
Sorry, thank you. I get so excited by the question.
I'm going to do it quickly. So did Jesus appoint 12 disciples to represent the 12 tribes of Israel, or was it a tidying up done by the gospel writers?
So, I've lost my train. I had an answer then. I think the really interesting thing is that we have made a lot more of the 12 than even the gospel writers do. You find the 12 mentioned very rarely in the gospels. We've made a big deal of them. And I'm going to say something that I may be wrong on, so just. But as far as I can remember, I cannot remember an occasion in the Gospels where the 12 themselves are called apostles in the Gospels. I might be wrong, but if they are, it's a very, very rare occasion. So basically what's happened is later Christian history has made a lot more of the 12 than I think probably was around. Because even, you know, they slip in the Gospels from talking about the disciples and you think, oh, it means 12. And then you've got, so a little example, which I noticed when I was reading Mark recently, is Jesus sends two disciples off to prepare the Passover meal, and later Jesus and the 12 arrive, which is interesting for all sorts of reasons, not least how many people were there at the Passover meal, at least 15, because there were Jesus, the 12, and the two had gone off to prepare the Passover meal. The implication is there are more than that. So the gospel writers do not use the word disciple or apostle technically. We subsequently do that technically. So I haven't really answered your question, but I kind of have, which is that I think it's more important to us than it was originally. I think the 12 were important, but I don't think they had the load of importance that we subsequently give them.
I'm going to slip in a quick question here. So do you think where we are now with the Me Too movement and women, I think, being listened to in a different way than we have been, do you think we're about to see a recognition of that, you know, learning in tranquility, that we may rest a little in an understanding that we should be striving for equality, and some of the power systems that have been in place very much in the church, as when all with all these other places that we're seeing women start to be taken seriously, do you feel encouraged, or do you think we're just going to be here for a bit and then we'll go back to how it's always been?
Depends whether you're asking my optimistic self or my pessimistic self. So my optimistic self is, yes, you know, this has been an enormous breakthrough, and we life will now be different in many ways. My pessimistic self is, I'm an old feminist. Really old feminist. So I was a feminist in the 80s. And in the 80s, I really thought that this was it. You know, we were there where we are now then. And it all disappeared in the 90s and the noughties. So I think one of the interesting things is my optimistic self says, no, we've made an enormous breakthrough and now things are different. My pessimistic self says, I was here before and I saw it slip back again. And maybe there is a midpoint, maybe there's an Anglican middle way between my optimistic self and my pessimistic self, which says that we will, of course, slip back, but maybe we won't slip back quite so far.
People who have power really don't like letting go, do they?
No. Well, why would they?
Yeah, well, for those who are in a position of privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Yes. Can I just say a little thing about the Me Too, though? Because for me, it's a really important thing. Is the thing that for me was really important about the Me Too movement is I, over the years, have experienced all sorts of stuff, from the really very, very unpleasant through to comments and people making, you know, kind of people going, women shouldn't speak on platforms in skirts, that kind of thing. You know, kind of all the way, kind of all of those.
That's because people can see up your skirt if you're on the platform.
It wasn't that short. and I think the thing that I realised is that there is a culture that you take it. And what I realised in talking to a lot of my female friends is there are certain things that I have never told anyone, not even my lovely husband who's down there, because you just take it. You just go, it's par for the course, I'm a woman, I accept this. And for me, what Me Too has done has gone, actually, we need to say these things, and we need to say them out loud, because until we say them out loud, nobody knows it's going on. And so that, for me, is one of the really, really significant things, is we need to start naming what has happened. And how you do it in a positive way, I'm not quite sure. But it is, you know, for my two teenage daughters, it's really important to me that we need to start naming it. And then perhaps we may not slip back quite so far.
And it's good to support. If anyone's doing it, to stand alongside them, men and women, it is incredibly helpful if you're trying to do that in your local church communities. So, thank you. I go back to what I said I do. Lady at the front here. So our friend at the front doesn't really like, she finds Paul difficult. And
I'm sure she's the only one here.
Yeah. We all love Paul, right? And you enjoyed reading the book because it gave you different perspectives on the people in the story also finding Paul a different difficult character. So where do we go next if we find a lot to help us in your book?
What I'm trying to do in writing the book is to say people, I think, often assume that Paul spoke, everyone went, oh yeah, and then they just, and everyone loved him, and therefore nobody disagreed with him. What I was trying to do is say he was controversial then, and you can tell that from the New Testament. If you take nothing else away, what I'm trying to do is to say you don't have to like him, but he's still important. The thing I think is, for me, really interesting is I don't think I would have liked him as a person. I'm very happy to be 2,000 years away from him, reading his letters. In person, I think I would have found him insufferable and wanted to give him a bit of a smack. And so therefore, I think what I would want to say to you is, I think that's okay. Well, obviously, I think it's okay because I do it. One of the really interesting things about the inspiration of Scripture is we've kind of slipped from saying Scripture is inspired and I can hear of God by reading Scripture into the people who are representing God in these texts were all lovely and nice people and I have to like them all. You know, I kind of go through the Old Testament prophets going, I wouldn't want Jeremiah to come for dinner and I wouldn't want Amos. You know, I'd be hard-pressed to find biblical characters I could make a dinner party out of.
That's a good game.
Yeah, it'd be quite fun, wouldn't it? I think what I'm wanting to say is the biblical writers are not God. God is God. And biblical writers, with all their flawed humanity, and they're kind of like us, good mostly and irritating in parts. And some of them, like Paul, are irritating in more parts than other people. And I think in Where Would You Go Next is with permission, full permission, not to like him, but nevertheless to recognise that some of the things he says are really important. And even, as the Corinthians did, not to agree with him the whole time. He isn't completely right, I don't think, where I'd be strung up for saying that in some context. But it's really important to recognise that and to accept that.
Over there in the back. Imagine you're in a room full of progressive Christians.
Yeah, I'm struggling to do that, but I'll do really hard.
So we've had a good go at LGBT, and we've had a good go at women's equality. We are involved.
Yes.
Yeah, we're involved in that process. What haven't we spotted yet?
Children. I think it's, for me, it's a really, really important bit. You know, people say, do you think children would have been present in communion in the early church? Yeah, because they were having dinner in a house. They were hardly going to go, no, out you go, we're at an important sacred moment. I think we simply factor out children in our worship, in our theology, in our talking, in everything, until we actually take seriously that children children weren't included, they were there. You know, if you see, nobody made the decision, shall we or shall we not include children? Children were a fundamental part of early Christianity.
So when did that start then, the exclusion of them?
I would say what happens, you get a really interesting movement between the first and second centuries, as Christianity becomes more and more popular, that it moves out of the private into the public. It also, incidentally, affects how women are treated. Because while Christianity is in the private sphere of everyday homes, women, of course, were fully present because women were in private. But when you move into the public, and in a Roman world where women had huge influence privately, kind of in varied situations, less influence publicly, then they became less important. Exactly the same happened with children. So as Christianity grew out of the home into churches, particularly built churches, into a public space, then they were factored out in many ways. And so there's a really interesting thing about how do we factor them, well, not factor them back in, but actually return to that understanding of private with children right at the heart of the whole community.
If Phoebe had to give 3 talks at Greenbelt next year, what would they be on? I'm going to write this down.
Forgiveness, vocation, and letting the past be the past.
Well, she is writing it as well.
Lady over there.
Is there a translation that Paula would recommend, or do we all need to learn New Testament Greek?
Yeah,
which is another good idea for a series of workshops.
Yes, yes, yeah, you do. No, you don't. No, there is not a translation that I would recommend. My recommendation is never read, if you're doing serious, no, when I say never read the Bible with less than 3 translations. If you want to study a passage, if you want to get into a passage, never do it with fewer than 3 translations. Because what each, you'll probably know, each translation has a different emphasis on what they're trying to do. So you will have, if you know a spectrum about translations, you have right at the end of this spectrum is formal equivalence. And formal equivalence is word for word translation. So you kind of that's the ones that aim to be the most accurate. At the other end of the spectrum is what we call dynamic equivalence, which is where you try and translate the meaning rather than the actual words. And then off the end of that spectrum are paraphrases. Sadly, paraphrases have dropped out of fashion. I think they're great, but they've dropped out of fashion. So I would recommend that you have one that aims to be really, really accurate, one that aims to be really, really communicatory, you know, kind of gets the meaning, and then something that is very unfamiliar to you. Because I think one of the really vibrant things about translation is we know what the text says, don't we? We get really used to stories. If you can get a translation that is surprising to you. The Message is a Marmite translation. But the reason why I like The Message is because it jolts you out. The other thing to do, if you know any other languages, read the Bible in a language that you know that's not English. Because again, you get it, you make it unfamiliar. Can I just have a teensy rant in this company? The one translation I do not like at all is the ESV, English Standard Version. And the reason why I don't like it is because they have deliberately exclusivized their translation. So they made a deliberate theological decision that where in the NRSV it says brothers and sisters, they will only translate it as brothers. So they have deliberately written women out of the text. And another thing. Of the 167 people who are cited as having contributed to the ESV translation, whether by translating it, by consulting on it, by editing it, out of 167 people, 3 women are noted, none of whom have doctorates. So, and they're right down. You have to really read through all the lists until you get right down to the end. And therefore, I don't think it's a reliable translation. Rant over.
if we had more time, I would give you more ranting. Is your book available to buy in the bookshop on site?
I think we can ask the lovely Church House Bookshop people over there, and I think they will say...
In the bookshop. Are you doing any other talks at Greenbelt this year?
No, I'm done.
Oh, you're done.
Sorry, I'm done.
But if people haven't, people at the back and people who haven't been able to get into here, or friends you know who would have enjoyed hearing what Paul has had to say, you will be able to listen to the recording that will be available via the Greenbelt website. I'd like to thank you. I have so enjoyed listening to you speak.
Thank you.
Today and yesterday, and I have learned so much, and I have been greatly encouraged. If we'd like to give Paula a round of applause.